You're with Raph.
Cast your mind back to Saturday, March 14. The Grand Prix had been cancelled the day before. On the 14th, the Saturday, we recorded our 100th confirmed case of corona. The number of confirmed cases was doubling every 3 days or so, surging from less than 200 to more than 2,000 within 12 days. And at the time, the New South Wales and Victorian government forced the issue and the shutdown begins. Now, between that weekend and the 18th of April, we now know about 1 million jobs were lost. 1 million in just 5 weeks. That is a big cost. The Federal Treasury thinks the cost of the lockdown right now is $4 billion every week. So these are the costs we can measure. We can't, of course, measure the costs of the deaths we avoided. If we hadn't shut down when we did, because Italy didn't. If we hadn't had the ability to test as well as we did, because America didn't have that capability. If we hadn't stopped people coming here. If we hadn't asked people from overseas to isolate for 14 days, because Britain didn't. So how do we know how bad it would have been? That is a cost that is harder to measure. So today, what is the cost of what we have done? And was it worth it? Joining us is Professor Gigi Foster from Radio National's The Economists podcast and Adjunct Professor Bill Botell from the Kirby Institute for Infection and Immunity. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, lovely to be here.
Thanks, Raph.
I'll start with you, Gigi. Has it been worth it so far, do you think?
Very hard to know, really, Raph, because we really didn't have economist modeling in the room as part of the input into these decisions. It requires knowing what would have been and, you know, what we've actually sacrificed in terms of economic health and human welfare in the pursuit of trying to contain infection rates and death rates. And I think I haven't seen convincing modeling for Australia that actually counts up those costs.
I'll bring Bill Bartell in a moment, but Gigi, are you saying that because we can't know the impact yet of the economic burden, it's too hard to know if it was worth it? Is that what you mean?
Well, I think that that's the modelling that would tell us whether it was worth it. I'm quite convinced that in terms of the global shutdown, it's very easy to say that that was not worth it for the world as a whole, because, and we're starting to see the kinds of suffering that any economist would have predicted in the developing world right now: famine, civil unrest, people being plunged back into poverty that they'd only escaped from a couple decades previously. So I think clearly it was not worth it for the number of people who are going to be suffering. Within Australia per se, just within our borders, I think it can also very easily be argued that we shouldn't have had a lockdown. But again, I didn't see a discussion happening about that. There are many ways to quantify the costs of this shutdown in terms of qualities, in terms of well-bees, in terms of statistical lives lost. And I'd like to see a full accounting of that before being, you know, so confident that we've done the right thing.
Bill Bartell, you were one of those on this program on Q&A advocating to go hard, go fast before that happened here. You heard there from Gigi Foster. Do you think she's right? It's too hard to tell if it was worth it?
No, I don't. I think it's quite clear it was worth it to act when we did. I think we could have acted earlier, but about the middle of March, as you said in your intro, the position was forced by the state premiers particularly, which is to their great credit. And by doing that, we really did knock out the capacity of the virus to transmit rapidly and freely, as we saw regrettably take place in the United Kingdom and the United States. Of course, nobody can ever quantify what would have happened had those things not taken place, but I think we can all agree that it would have been far worse than the very good results comparatively that we've had. But remembering still that we've had almost 100 people die and almost 7,000 cases of COVID, and COVID is a very serious disease. It's not influenza. It's still got long-term ramifications, which we only find out every day, and it's not a very good thing to have at all and even to recover from. So, yes, I think it's been worth it. I don't think you can really easily say that we should not have done what we did. I think the Australian people understand that, and certainly the Australian leaders can see it working out very well.
Bill Bartell, we're sort of weighing up two things that it seems to me are very difficult to measure. You can't measure the value of lives that we still have. You can't put a dollar value on that. Mm. And we also can't measure yet the impact that the economic shutdown has on people's lives. So is it a, do you think it's something you can actually make a measurement of, or is it a values judgment?
Well, all economics, all social activity is basically based on values. I mean, we do impute value to human lives and to happiness and liberty and freedom. Economics is not something that stands apart from human activity, and many of the economic values that people espouse are based on values and beliefs about human life and how we should be happy and free and so on. So I don't really see there's a distinction to be made between the economy and people. I mean, the people are the economy, and clearly people cannot go to work in our economy if they feel that their safety and health is going to be put unreasonably at risk and unquantifiably at risk. So as we move into the next stage, we've got to move cautiously and modestly, as I think the Premier of South Australia said, and realising too that it's going to be conditionally. The Australian people have done a great job in knocking out the transmission of COVID-19 in recent weeks by withdrawing. Now, if they go back, as we all wish, that there's increased economic activity and greater demand, I think we can all agree on that. But they cannot do it in a way that really allows the virus to transmit rapidly and quickly. Otherwise, it'll be like whack-a-mole. We'll just go back to where we were, and that wouldn't be good at all. So we've got a conditional good result, but it will be equally conditional upon us doing some things in very different ways in the next weeks and months as we learn to live with this virus for the foreseeable future.
Gigi, I hear what you're saying, that it's very difficult to count the economic cost of the steps we've taken. But isn't the problem with that argument, if we get this wrong, we end up with catastrophe. We end up with Italy or Britain and sort of large-scale deaths and overwhelming the health system. Isn't that the more important factor in our decision-making than whether or not we can measure the economic impact of, you know, multi-generational unemployment?
I absolutely don't think so. I think what is very clear is that when we hear discussions about what we've done, and in Bill's comments just there, you heard it, there is a narrow laser focus on the COVID-19 related human welfare impacts, direct deaths, direct infections, danger from COVID-19, with an absence of perspective about the variety of other things that can actually affect human welfare, human life, and human happiness. Economics, I agree with Bill, is about life and livelihood. The goal of economics as a discipline is philosophical. It is the maximization of human welfare as a whole, not human welfare as judged by how many people have died from COVID-19. Even if we were to lose 100,000 people from a pandemic in Australia, an epidemic in our shores, I believe there still should be economic modeling about the costs of imposing whatever the restrictions are that are feasible to prevent that loss. We don't even know whether the lockdown here actually is what has saved any amount of lives or how many lives have been saved. But it's the feasible alternative that we should be evaluating in terms of costs and benefits. And I didn't hear Bill talk at all about the kinds of costs that have been clearly borne already, whether it's deaths of despair, whether it's GDP going down and then causing unemployment, which causes human welfare to decrease, lesser quality of education for a whole cohort of school students and university students, the regressive impacts in terms of domestic violence. There's just a massive number of effects that I just have not seen quantified properly in the decision about whether to lock down or not. And there are examples in the international community that have not done the serious lockdown. Okay. We have. Sweden is the leading one.
Bill, can I bring you in there? There's a whole lot of things we're not measuring and not assessing in our decision making. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's an interesting academic debate, and in due course, no doubt, all of those numbers will be generated, and we'll be able to take a look backwards and see what the costs and benefits were. I agree with Gigi. It's not possible to say what the immediate effects of lockdown are because we've not done that sampling and research. So that will be a very interesting and valuable thing to do. But to go back, say, 4 or 5 weeks, would the argument have been not to have done anything? I don't think that would have been acceptable to the Australian people. And I certainly don't think it would have been acceptable to the Australian Prime Minister or leaders, the people who are really responsible by their daily decisions to look after the health and welfare of the people. And I think avoiding immediate death and avoiding injury for an unknown disease for which there's no vaccine or cure, I think that's the highest
responsibility. You're saying, Bill, they didn't really have a choice. They can't measure the sorts of things Gigi's talking about, but they did know if they didn't act, it would have been catastrophic.
Correct.
And they didn't really have another choice. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, so Gigi, how do you respond to that? Because that's very much where the government, state and federal, are coming from, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that debate, exactly as Bill says, 4 or 5 weeks ago, was very much focused on the epidemiological evidence or models that we knew at the time, which in fact turned out in hindsight to be orders of magnitude off in terms of how bad it actually got here in Australia.
Well, they're only off because we acted, aren't they?
Well, that's the question. Is it true that it was only brought so low in Australia because of the actions we've taken? Again, I would point to Sweden, which has not closed primary schools, which has not locked down their entire economy. They're still going to feel economic effects, but they haven't severed the links, many of the links.
But they have a much worse death rate than their neighbours, and they've got a death rate that's much higher than ours. So that doesn't seem like an approach worth following.
But if you were to follow Sweden's path and get a similar type of per capita death rate that they have, adjusted for Australia's population, you'd be talking about 6,000 or 7,000 deaths in Australia right now instead of whatever we have, 90 or something. And that is actually a pretty small number when you compare it to the number of people who die from many other causes, including, for example, taking our lives in our hands when we go into cars every day to go to work. So the idea that, you know, people shouldn't be taking undue risk to go to work, well, it's not undue when we are getting in a car. You know, and by the way, it's a disease that affects mainly, in terms of deaths, mainly older people with pre-existing conditions.
Okay.
And that means that there's a capacity to put a lot of people back to work who aren't in that situation and aren't going to be at that kind of risk level.
Bill, if I can just get you to address that briefly, if you can. I mean, she is effectively saying, look, it would have been 6,000 or 7,000 deaths, but maybe that's a more acceptable burden than the burden we've placed on everyone with this economic shutdown.
I agree with Gigi on this. I think the modelling that was done in January, and we still haven't seen that modelling, was very much overstated. And I suspect one of the reasons it was overstated was because people who were responsible at that stage did not understand how quickly the Australian people would respond and change their behaviour if they thought things warranted it. And the point about Sweden is also a very interesting one. The people in charge of the Swedish response did actually put all of this out there for public debate and discussion way back in January, February, to their great credit. I don't agree with it, but I think it was a very forthright and responsible thing to do, to involve the entire Swedish population and say that there were costs and benefits from what people have called herd immunity or letting it run or whatever, and seeing what would happen. And it has to be said to their credit that over the last several months they have stuck with that, even as their death rate has gone up that's different from their neighbours, and they've had the thing going through the economy. There are people who disagree with that in Sweden, but it was up front and all out there. And we never had that debate, if you like, in Australia at any level. It basically, for most people, came almost out of the blue at the beginning of March. And a lot of time and debate took place over those 2 or 3 weeks that, in an ideal world and really in our politics, should have happened months before.
Some of your texts. Gigi has a point. A friend of ours is a first responder who's seen a big jump in suicides they're attending. There's more that can kill than COVID. Someone else saying, listening to Gigi, I can see how clearly why economics is referred to as the dismal science. One person's job for a period of time is not worth another's life. It's not so complex. That's from James. Gigi, isn't the main... I'm going to ask you what the main weakness in your argument is, but I will. Isn't the main weakness with your argument, this gets away so fast? And that's what's driving the Australian government response. Maybe we'd be like Sweden, or maybe we'd be like Italy. You're right. We don't know precisely which of the measures we've enacted is the reason we've done so well. But if you lift off the wrong one, all of a sudden there's body bags piling up in trucks. Isn't that, you know, road deaths don't grow exponentially. These deaths do.
Indeed, it's a very interesting point, and I think this is one that people have come back to, particularly the epidemiological scare models that have said, you know, if we don't, then we will have this, you know, R naught of 3 point whatever, and it's going to flow, you know, hugely,
rate, yeah.
Right? The transmission rate, the domino effect, essentially. Well, the problem is that on the economic side, that's also in play. And people don't understand it sometimes because they haven't really got a full picture of how the economy works. But once you start breaking up employers and employees' relationships, once you start stopping people from being able to get jobs when they come on the labor market, or stopping them, you know, being able to graduate, or whatever the thing is, you're interrupting the beautiful, you know, well-oiled machine that is the conveyor belt of the economy, you know, delivering capital and labor into the places where it needs to be, and deliver value to all of us. And so there is also an epidemiological sort of aspect to the way that the economy works. There's dominoes that go on, the spillovers, multiplier effects. Right? We talk about it when we talk about stimulus. The same thing happens when there's a retraction in the economy. And so I think the idea that somehow we can just press pause on the economy and everything will be fine, we'll come back, V-shaped, you know, recession recovery will happen, but somehow on the epidemiological side, that's not the case, that there's going to be this, you know, infection, that's a bit of a false dichotomy. In fact, you know, you've got an infection, a contagion aspect in the economy as well. And that cost, again, has not been quantified in a way that I've seen for Australia.
Yeah. Bill, you know that debate, and she's right to a large degree, isn't it? We've no idea of the economic damage we have wrought with this solution to a health problem.
No, when we're finding out every day. I do think we made one error, or a big error was made in the decision about the 22nd of March to effectively send a lot of people to unemployment, if you recall on that day when there were all those lines outside Centrelink. And in doing that, the government decided not to directly subsidise all employers to keep people on the books, as it were, as they did in Germany and some other European countries.
As significant as that is, Bill, isn't that on the margins? I mean, if you shut the economy down, you shut the economy down, don't you?
Well, I'm going to the point that Gigi made about severing the links between employers and employees. There was a better way to do that in the sequencing that did not involve shifting a million Australians onto the unemployment lists and severing that relationship. And also we know that people are on contracts less than 12 months, which I know with a lot of people in, say, acting and entertainment, hospitality, have fallen out into very regrettable circumstances in unemployment. So the degree to which we have unemployment was not just an act of God. It was actually as a result of decisions that were made about the 21st of March, yes, and that created this unemployment problem. And it is that much harder to put it back together again.
Yeah.
I think so. We've got to deal with that. Anyway, however we got where we are here now, and we just have to be very cautious.
Okay, can I ask you about the caution? This Friday, National Cabinet's expected to be planning for a real easing of restrictions. Next week, some classes go back in New South Wales and Queensland. Nothing is in stone, but I'd be surprised if there aren't kids in classrooms in a few weeks' time, some of them at least in Victoria. I'll start with you, Gigi, but I want to hear from both of you. What do we need to do next? We are where we are, Gigi. What do we need to do next?
I absolutely think we need to open schools. I think having children underfoot is a huge problem, both for the kids and for the parents. And it's a regressive problem. It hurts more the children who are in disadvantaged families. That's a no-brainer. The next thing I think we need to do is get people back to work in the sectors where they've been laid off, particularly tourism, the various cafes, retail, etc. To the extent that's going to be able to come back. I think some Australian families...
So can I just clarify, Gigi, when you say cafes and restaurants, with social distancing but opening them, is that what you mean?
Well, that's a question, and I think it'd be interesting to debate which way is the best way to go. I mean, we haven't talked about the end game here, but if there's no vaccine, then we're going to be living with this virus for a long time. There's been the argument put, and I'd like to see a real discussion about it, of whether or not an immunological defense is actually better than an economic defense against this virus, whether we should in fact just aim to use our fittest and strongest and healthiest people to generate an immune response. We don't know enough about how immunity develops. Obviously, that's knowledge knowledge that will be coming out over the next few weeks to months. And it would be great to see Australia grab onto that knowledge and figure out what the optimal path is. But I think the first step would be with social distancing, because that's politically palatable. But to open up some of that domestic tourism industry, which has been so hard hit, and hopefully some of us richer Australians will take some holidays within Australia, because we can't get out at the moment, and help to prop up some of those businesses.
Bill, I'm assuming you don't agree with Gigi. At what rate and under what conditions would you think it's a good idea to open things up?
Well, I think we should open up. I absolutely agree. We've got to restore demand in the economy and get the economy moving to the extent that we can. But of course, we have to do it very mindful of the health and welfare of, say, customers in a cafe and the workers in a cafe. It can't proceed further and faster than is medically and advised for health reasons. And remembering too that COVID-19 is a new disease, and we have 6 months understanding of what it does in a very dynamic situation. And nobody 3 or 4 months ago could do anything other than assume the worst about what COVID-19 would turn out to be. It's a very unpleasant disease, and we understand that there are big ramifications for people who get sick and recover from it. So we're not dealing with a known quantity in this particular case. We've got to be very, very cautious about allowing it to spread as if it were a lesser disease like an influenza or something like that, that we understand.
Look, we'll get to people's calls on 1300 222 774. But Bill, Gigi mentioned the long-term plan. Can we have a long-term plan if we don't really understand the disease?
No, I think we're learning as we go. We learn,
and that's why it's so important. You attune your response as we go.
We have to learn about the disease. I mean, it is a viral disease that was unknown to science 8 months ago. And every day, the best scientists, researchers in the world are telling us more about the longer-term ramifications of infection and how to deal with it and how to treat it. And that helps in informing every step that we take. We need the facts and the evidence. You can't proceed on the basis of hope. You've just got to do on the facts and evidence and the science and see where that leads us to in the next week and the next month and the next several months until hopefully we get a treatment or a vaccine.
Okay. Gigi, I'm interested in your views of the long game, but is any of the stuff you're concerned about, the economic impact, is any of that stuff measurable, say, over, I don't know, 6 months? Can we measure the economic impact long term?
Well, I mean, we certainly have the tools to do so. The question is whether that work will actually be of interest or be palatable to the popular press or even academic journals. I hope so. We have tools, for example, to measure the impact of declines in economic output or economic activity, and the relationship of that to unemployment, to deaths of despair. Obviously, there are some positives to human welfare from limiting a bit the GDP growth that we've seen. For example, fewer people dying on the roads from car accidents, right?
Fewer flu.
That's also because we're going to be washing our hands more. Do hope some of our good habits from this period stick, right? But I want to go back to the question about uncertainty that Bill raised, and I want to draw an analogy to the early days of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. I lost an uncle in the mid-80s from that epidemic, and we didn't know exactly, as Bill's saying, there was a fog of uncertainty about this disease. We didn't know what was going on, and at the end, by 40 years after it was initially discovered, we've lost something like 30 to 40 million people from this disease, right? And so in that sort of scenario, we tried to take proportionate action. We knew that it was hitting the gay communities. We knew it was hitting the IV drug user communities. So we took action in those communities first. Then we took action in terms of the blood supply when we realized, oh my gosh, it's transferable through blood. And of course, we had some horrible results in the interim while we were still learning. But as Bill said, the entire focus of the world scientific community at the moment, in infectious disease, is pretty much on this. So we are going to get inventions. We're going to get creative responses to this thing, whether it's treatments or vaccine. And we're already seeing some promising directions for the treatment side, certainly. So I do think we will be able to make better decisions, and it'll be a less scary thing within 3 months because we will have some treatments that bring down the case fatality rate. Now, yes, I think there will probably be some unfortunate lessons like, oh, when you've had this disease and it's been this bad, you're going to have longer term effects on this system, that system. And this is why COVID-19 has made the world a worse place. No matter which way you cut it, no matter what we do, there's no zero death, zero suffering scenario here. Right. Okay. So the question is, which is the worst, the worst world that we want to avoid, which is the best world of a bad lot that we want to be in?
10-second response, Bill Bartel. I want to know if you're positive or negative or more positive than you were, say, 6 weeks ago.
Well, I think we're through the scary part, at least in Australia, and if we keep our wits about us. But as Gigi said, and it's quite clear, we're now up for the hard part. Yeah. And that hard part requires a lot more research, facts and evidence on all the sides, economic, health, everything. And on that basis, I think collectively we'll come up with the best possible way ahead that minimises the economic damage, but very importantly, doesn't have a big death load and caseload that just goes on without control or managing it.
Oh, let's just hope that doesn't happen. Really huge thank you to both of you. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks very much, Raf.
Thanks, Raf.
Adjunct Professor Bill Bartel there from the Kirby Institute and Professor Gigi Foster from Radio National's The Economist podcast. She's at the University of New South Wales as well.
You're with Raf.